listening to The Point, and joining us now is Angela Marcelino, a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. Her book is The True Natives of Cape Cod, Massachusetts and Their Food Ways, Recipes with Stories of Food, History, Culture, and Identity. Hi, Angela.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Great. So, you know, I was thinking if I had to put this book in a category, say in the library or a bookstore, I don't know where I would put it because it's not really, it's a cookbook, but it's also got all this history and these stories. So tell us a little bit about what inspired you to put this book together.
Well, it started when I mentioned in the book, like most Native Americans, and it's hard to talk about Indigenous. I prefer to call us Indigenous, but I do use the term Native American because it's more commonly known. But I'd prefer to call Indigenous people. Indigenous people, we live kind of a quiet life. And we have the opposite value system where talking in public is not normally good. But we're doing it now to tell our story on our terms. So like most Indigenous people and Indigenous communities, I was later in life and my kids got out of high school and I decided to move home and work for my tribe. A lot of people in Indigenous communities do that throughout the United States. It's kind of it's a cultural obligation and it's an honor to work for your tribe to advance them. So my background was grant management and I've worked for other tribal nations. And I went home to do a grant management program for my tribe. So instantly I got involved with the local boards and museums because I have a love of history. And I was invited to many of our local cultural events. And I was bringing along dishes, you know, at these potlucks and so forth for the events. And I realized as I was cooking a lot of the local native fare, that this didn't come to me by an accident. These dishes, my mother taught me how to make them. And I realized that many of my tribal members knew how to make all of the same local recipes. So I started to look into how these recipes came to be. What components were the Native American components, cultural and natural resources? And what part of the components were brought to us by the settlers or the colonies? And I realized that the recipes and the food were telling me a story.
Yeah. And you talk about, you know, you have the history of the Wampanoag people and their, you know, their history with this land. And you write, Indigenous foodways merged with European food culture to create America's first recipes.
Yeah, I mean, in my case, I recommend, by the way, anybody that doesn't know their ancestry, please take time to know who you are. It's a beautiful journey. And I learned a lot of new things, by the way. I'm 63 years old. And when you're 63 years old, you think you know a lot of things. And then you don't. There's so much more you need to learn, you know. Yeah. So during my research, and I did a lot of research for this book, I learned a lot of things.
Yeah.
And the book became more than a cookbook. It became a book about history as you read, personal stories about my identity, who I am, you know, and how I tell that story. And then, especially in my case, I realized my ancestors, of course, were big part of huge benchmarks of the development of this country.
Yeah.
So I got to tell that story as well.
Yeah, I say your own story weaves in the cultures of the Wampanoag tribe, but also your Cabo Verde heritage, right? So tell us, and you say these are the two cultures you grew up with. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's very common union on the Cape to be Wampanoag heritage or and Portuguese heritage. They are the people that are of this region. And when I would travel across the country, people would say, oh, where are you from? And I would say Cape Cod. And they'd say, well, what is your ethnic heritage? And I'd say, well, primarily Wampanoag and Portuguese Cape Verde. And then I have Azorean heritage as well. And I would say that, and they would look at me like I had three heads. And I was really kind of, upset about it. I said, gee, why don't they know that my people live in this region? And of course, the more common response is, I thought all the Indians are gone. Which is really horrific to hear.
Sure.
But I think most people are good. I think they just need more information.
Right. Yeah. And so you have these short stories accompanying the recipes. One that stands out to me was your uncle's baked mashed pea eel. And I thought, not so easy to find eel nowadays.
The book also talks on conservation, and which is a huge effort of all Indigenous people. Conservation is always at the forefront. People, they don't realize this, but in our culture, we're very sensitive to the land. We know when the herring is running. The whole tribe is talking about it for weeks, the signs of the herring. When the bear crossed the Bourne Bridge, I always laugh. I was working in the office. The whole tribe was buzzing. The bear had come back to Cape Cod. What a great sign, right?
Yeah.
And he lost his way to Wellfleet. I mean, we were just thrilled that he found his way home. We live that life. It's very much in our conversations. Who caught what that day? How many herring are in the water? And the eels were depleted, and we notice it because it's still part of our food system.
Yeah. But they were plentiful at one time.
They were, and they're beautiful to eat. In fact, eel are very common, was very common in London as well. It was a European food. When the settlers came here, I talk about the Columbian Food Exchange, and some foods had already reached Europe. Like squashes and so forth. And they went up from South America in the 1500s, but they were America's foods from the America continent. And it was so funny, they made their way up to Europe and overpopulated it because it was such sustainable food, like the potato and the tomatoes.
Yeah.
And it kind of pushed them off their land to come to ours.
Yeah, and you're right. Shellfish was not widely embraced, at least in public, by the European colonists. In fact, shellfish was so abundant they considered it to be lowly food of little value. It was not until the 1870s that the New England upper class recognized lobster as a delicacy. Hard to imagine now, right? When we look at, how much shellfish is in demand and the price and all of that.
Yeah, I also touch on as Native Americans, our value system and our lifestyle. Now in 2024, if you went to a doctor today as a Native American and you ate the way Native Americans ate, which was high fiber, low fat food, running 20 miles a day to get to your hunt or to forage the shorelines. You would be a model health example, high fiber, low fat. You'd be great. It's really come full circle now that the conservation movement, healthy lifestyle, we had them all in place.
Yeah. Let's talk about clam bakes. I mean, I think that's a people when they come to Cape Cod, they always think about clam bakes, and you've got it all laid out in how we do a clam bake.
When we come home for our powwows, which is our spiritual time, where we get together as one large family, there are over 2,700 Wampanoags. And people, the term tribe means a group of people that are all genetically linked. It puts us in a very interesting position in this country. We're tied to our land for over 10,000 years. We know each other for several generations. Native Americans are in a very unique position in this country. And we fight to keep our presence every day, and to live our lives as Native Americans. It's always in the forefront. But the clam bake always reminds me of powwow. It's our homecoming. We get together. And we do it automatically. It's a very ancient, the clam bake is a very ancient native technique. You find all indigenous people of the world cook food underground with the hot rocks, in our case, seaweed, very much like the Hawaiian indigenous or the Mexicans' barracota, which is like a barbecue barracota underneath the ground. They use a cow head or a pork head, and they cook it underground, which sounds maybe not flattering to others, but we do it very automatically every year. We get our family together. We need a lot of helpers for a clam bake to gather the seaweed in the wood, and it becomes a huge family event, gathering the quahogs with the children in the morning. It's a several day event, and then you have to watch the clam bake. You don't just get up and split. You have to have helpers. But it's a beautiful time, and it's honoring a very ancient practice when it's done right.
Now, you mentioned Hawaii. You spent time as a child in Oahu, right? So tell us about the influence of Hawaiian food culture on you.
Oh, Hawaii was a huge influence on me. My parents went to Hawaii, and I write about it. I'm not exactly sure why, because nobody ever leaves New England. And I also talk about my culture as a New Englander too, because people don't, pick up on, you have heritage, you have ethnic heritage, and then you have culture, which is a whole different animal. But when I was in Hawaii, it was very difficult for me because I was not of their culture. And I kind of, as a child, I became very introverted and decided to live in the library. And I became like an amateur anthropologist. I decided to study the other cultures around me, the Pacific culture, Asian culture, and the indigenous Hawaiians, which were such a fascinating ancient culture. So I became highly aware of other cultures at a very young age and wanted to know everything about other cultures all the time. It was a huge experience for me. And as a child, I was also interested in cooking, and I had hung out with many other people from these cultures, and I learned about how to cook some of their recipes as well.
Right, and that recipe that goes with that story is Angie's Asian lobster.
It's great. It's on the grill. We talk about Miss Bishop. I babysat for her for years, and she was of Chinese descent. And she would take me to all the Chinese food markets in Hawaii, and I would sit there, and she would pick out, what goes in the wonton pea. And I was a bit of a very strange child. I was highly fascinated
It sounds
with
like an
all of these
interesting
different things.
childhood for sure. Now, this sort of made me chuckle. You mentioned that your grandmother didn't allow you to do much in her kitchen. She only allowed a few people in, your Aunt Muriel and her sister-in-law, Aunt Dot, and your mother. You write, "Finally, at 63 years old, I was able to produce a duck that she would have approved of. I remembered her instructions with any form of bird, make sure it is properly dried out before roasting." So do you tried to get in her kitchen, but she was like, "Yeah, no."
Oh God, yeah. I mean, my grandmother was a staunch, Bostonian. There was no fussing around or fun going on
Serious
in
business in
that
that kitchen.
Protestant world, no. But I'm very grateful for her to this day. She taught me a lot that a structure, and that was in that household, a lot of structure going on.
This also made me laugh. You write, "Waking up to codfish cakes and eggs was nothing short of heaven. If you do not know what I'm talking about, you are not from Mashpee."
It's so true. Now that when I become an adult and I started to make these recipes, I really appreciate the work that goes into them. The codfish cake is a beautiful thing, but it's a lot of work, and you really need to know what you're doing when you create them.
And you go into the whole Peters family history, which is your family history. So there's as you're talking at the beginning of the book, we get a lot of that Peters family history.
The Peters family, with my grandfather being the selectman of the town for 37 years, the history is so powerful. It was the last one of the last Indian districts in the Commonwealth. And at that time, people that were indigenous or Native American, to speak, you just couldn't live anywhere. You had to go to one of these Indian district towns or a town that had a church because of the Praying Indian laws. I read, it was very, very sad for me to read that there were Native Americans in western part of Massachusetts, and they would ask to have to ask permission to live in that town.
Yeah.
It's very sad.
Yeah. It seems like the book, what a journey, right? As you mentioned, you got to do all this research and learn all of this. So to weave in this history and the stories with the traditional foods that you grew up
Foods that
with,
you grow.
what was that like for you?
Well, I think I re said it in my book. They were very difficult times as well. I realized that it was difficult because they were my family members. So when you look at history, when you read about Tisquantum that was in Plymouth, and that he came back and he saw that they had put the settlers had put new houses on the imprints of the Weetos of his dead relatives from the pandemic of smallpox. I cried. I mean, it was very moving for me. I said, how does one see that? Their whole family decimated and people putting homesteads on top of homesteads that were Weetus, that were of his family. So it was a beautiful experience, the research, but there were moments where it was really a little emotionally exhausting because it was personal.
And then, of course, reliving your childhood with some of the traditional foods, right? That like the fish cakes for breakfast and that sort of thing. What's been the reaction as I know you're starting out on your book tour. What's been the reaction for folks who've read the book?
I'm really thrilled. I laugh. I don't consider myself a writer by any means. I thought, well, we'll just put a cookbook together. But they get my book. They understand that it's not just a cookbook, it's something to be read from beginning to end, with a lot of research behind it. And I don't know, people are just being polite, but I'm getting a really beautiful response and some beautiful reviews. They like the way I weave the story and the history within the recipes. And I say, please use the recipes as well. But it's really more than a cookbook, much more.
Do you have a favorite recipe in the cookbook?
Oh, God.
It's like saying, do you have a favorite child? Is there one that you like to make more than another,
I would say my quahog chowder, which is my mother's. There's nothing better than a cup of homemade quahog chowder. You can't replicate that.
That's right.
And it's very the quahog chowder for Mashpee is like Mashpee to a people. Some people don't even know what quahogs are. You have to explain to them what quahogs are. But there's a pungent, sweet taste to a quahog that is like nothing else out there. And of course, I love the dried herring, which is the quaint herring. Most people would run away if they smelled it. It's beautiful. And there are other cultures that eat herring that's layered or fish that's layered in salt and fermented. And they also think it's wonderful.
The book is The True Natives of Cape Cod, Massachusetts and Their Food Ways, recipes with stories of food, history, culture, and identity. We'll have a link at our website, capeandislands.org. And Angela will be at a book signing at Barnes & Noble on May 27th. Angela, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening. The
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.